This is Frank Hymans recording an oral history interview with Laurie Anderson. Today is the 22nd of July, 2005, and this is for the Department of Housing's Millers Point Oral History Project. This interview is being recorded at 13 Eurella Lane, Woy Woy, New South Wales, and this is tape number MPFH7, Side A. Okay, Laurie, usually we ask people when we interview them is to give them some details, give us some details about their background. So can I first ask you your full name?
Lawrence William Anderson.
Right. And when were you born, Lawrence? Laurie?
26th of the 10th, 1927.
Where was that, do you know?
Murrumbina in Victoria.
Okay. Right. So you're a Victorian. Okay. Tell me a bit about your parents. What sort of people were they?
Well, my father was always on the land, and my mother was a trained nurse, and we lived at a little place called Yolunga, which was where I first started school, and we had a small farm there and an apple orchard. And it's funny, you remember particular things about that place. There was a family that used to live at a little place on the Prince's Highway. I think it was Long Worry was the name of it. And they came to do some contracting work for Dad on the farm, and they had rubber tyres on the tractor to travel to where it was going to work, and then they had to take the rubber tyres off and put steel wheels on, and during the process one of the wheels fell and pinned one of the Davis boys, whose name was Reg, underneath the tractor wheel. And Dad, with the help of what they used to call a Trawalla Jack, lifted the wheel off him, and phones were not as readily available as they are today, and got a message to his father, and he came in a motorbike and sidecar and took him to the Warrigal Hospital. And I've never ever forgotten the turmoil and the father arriving in the old motorbike and sidecar and putting his son in the sidecar. And the roads were only tracks, they weren't made roads. And we kept in touch with that family for many, many years afterwards. And Reg, who they ran a little service station on the highway, and I think it's been taken over by the society. And we got in touch with him and rang him up, and he passed away not so very long ago, which, we were really good friends for many, many years, although we didn't see one another for many, many years. But it was what they used to call bayonet country, which was bush country in those days. And if you wanted to extend the property, you just cleared a paddock by removing the trees and then planting whatever it was you wanted to plant, extending the orchard. Or if in the later stages Dad had some cattle, and it just went from there. And we left there and went to live in Warrigal, and my father ran a woodyard in Warrigal, and 3UL was the name of the radio station there, and Mum ran a guest house, and all the radio announcers used to live. One of them's name was Dick Smith. I think Dick's still in radio somewhere. And a lady by the name of Dorothy Jarvis, I think her name was. She was a lovely lady. I remember her. She had long blonde hair. And they used to live right opposite the radio station for convenience sake. And we left there and went on to another farm at a place called Berwick, which is between Dandenong and Warrigal on the Prince's Highway. And I started to get itchy feet, and Dad and I didn't see eye to eye about certain things at that point in time. So I left there and went to work at Sorrento, which is down on the Mornington Peninsula. And I was driving buses for the Peninsula Bus Company that used to operate between Portsea and Frankston because the train line used to end at Frankston. There was a spur line that went off down to the naval depot at Crib Point, which was where I finished up a few years later and used to travel on that train line when going on leave. And I got moved from there. I joined the Navy. They were having a lot of problems at the bus company with an independent bus company trying to be taken over by the bigger companies, and as they gradually took them over, staff became a problem. And so I decided that I'd do something else, and one of the boys there by the name of Frankie Beitzel, one of the drivers, he said, "Oh, I'm going to join the Army." And I said, "Oh, I don't like the Army." I said, "I think I'll join the Navy." So we did, and he joined the Army and then transferred from the Army back to the Navy, and we met up there. And I haven't spoken to Frank for some time now, but he went out to Maralinga to the where they were having the bomb tests, and whether it's a result of that or not, he became stricken with cancer, and the last time I met him, he wasn't very well. And he lived at Sunnybank in Queensland, but I haven't been in touch with him for a while. So during my term in the Navy, I did some time on the HMAS Australia, and then the position came available to come to... I did a training course in bricklaying and a training course in driving, and I was always interested in motor vehicles. And I got very good marks in my class in the training of driving section, and so I was transferred to HMAS Cuttable, which was a Shore depot in Sydney. And that's where I met Raima, my first wife, and we lived in a little place down in Lower Fort Street, down underneath the Harbour Bridge. And in those days, there were trams and buses. Buses, trams and trains used to all use the bridge. And the noise was horrendous, and I thought to myself, I'm never going to learn to live here. And a position became available driving Admiral Harry Showers. And I put in for that position and got it, but I only stayed a short period of time with him. And then Sir William McMahon became Minister for Navy and Air, and I was asked if I would like to be his chauffeur. And still remaining in the Navy and being under Navy disciplinary rules and what have you, but being on Mr. McMahon's personal staff and wearing uniform when required to wear uniform and wearing civilian clothes when required to wear civilian clothes got me into a bit of trouble with naval officers in the Cuttable establishment, because I had the keys to the limousine car that he was allocated, and the keys were in my possession, which upset a lot of the junior officers, that because he may want to go somewhere in the middle of the night, he would ring me and I would go down, the guard would open the gate, let me in, and I'd take the car, and it may come back that night, it may not come back for 2 or 3 days. And that seemed to worry a lot of the Navy officers. So on one occasion, my mother was sick in Melbourne, and we had an officer there, which was Lieutenant Commander Cooper. God bless his little soul. He didn't like me and I didn't like him, and I put in for some compassionate leave, which was where the problems used to get difficult, because Mr. McMahon was my immediate boss, but the Navy was the people that I was working for. And I put in for 7 days compassionate leave, and Mr. Cooper rejected my request. So I had spoken to Mr. McMahon about it, and he was very, very easy to speak to, and we often had conversations about things that were highly irrelevant to anything in the Navy. And so I went in I had approached him and said I'd probably be going away, but I would make arrangements for him to have a departmental car available. So I went in to see him, and he said, "Oh, I thought you were going to Melbourne." And I said, "No, I can't go. Lieutenant Commander Cooper said that I wasn't serious enough and that I didn't have any doctor's certificates, so I couldn't go." So Mr. McMahon said, "Well, you go home and pack your bag, garage the car, make arrangements for a vehicle for me, and be back here, and I'll have your air tickets. I have some paperwork to go to Navy office in Melbourne, and I want you to wait there, report to Navy office every day by phone, and when the paperwork is ready, return it to my office by hand." So that upset Mr. Cooper even more. And so I did that and was very grateful. And then things moved along. I was with him for quite some time, and I put in for a draft to a couple of ships going to various places that were considered combat zones, because I wanted to qualify for war service loans and things, which I never ever got enough time in an operational area to achieve. But I got married during that period. I was with Mr. McMahon, and I said to Val Kentish, who was one of his secretaries, "Do you think I should ask the minister to go to the wedding?" She said, "Well, he can only say no, and if you don't ask him, he might think it's a bit odd." So anyway, I asked him, and he said, "Oh, I don't make a point of going to staff's private functions, but leave it with me and I'll see, but don't make any special facilities available for me." So halfway through the meal after the wedding, he just came and appeared, so they promptly made arrangements to give him something to eat. And I was glad I asked him then, because he made a speech and met a lot of people. And from there I went to there was a ship going to the Queenborough, was going on a world trip doing hydrographics and doing water temperatures and oil temperatures in various conditions at sea. And the object of the exercise was, so if a ship was operating in the Antarctic and they wanted to send it into the tropics, that they could equip it with an oil and fuels that wouldn't that would stand up in both temperature changes. And it was a very interesting trip. We went to many places. We finished in Iceland. We were there for nearly 3 months in working in freezing conditions, and it was a world cruise. Came back via Gibraltar, went through the canal, Suez Canal, and when we got back, it was nearly time for me to re-engage. And so I contacted Frank, and I said, "Frankie Beitzel, the chap I'd spoken about previous, I think I'll go for another 6 years." And he said, "Oh, bugger him, I've had it." He said, "I'm that crook, I just want to get out." So he got invalided out on a pension, which was the beginning of the problems that he incurred the last time I saw him. And I thought, "Oh, well, I'll see if I can get a job." So they had a program where you were being discharged, you went and had an interview, and they endeavoured to find you a job. And I got a job with the Mobil Oil Company at a little place over at Pulpit Point, driving trucks and delivering fuel. And I always wanted to work for myself, so I scrounged around, saved a little bit of money. In the meantime, Margaret came along, and she wasn't very well. She had asthma and infantile dermatitis. And so I'd bought this sand truck, and I was locked into paying that off, and had a lot of mechanical problems with it. And so I got a job of a night down at the milk, where all the bulk milk containers used to come in down at Dairy Farmers. So I used to drive my truck during the day and then work down there at night just to get money to pay the medical expenses. So eventually sold that to someone and I bought a hire car, and I worked in the hire car industry and drove taxis on occasions to keep the money going. And then we bought a little sandwich shop at Miller's Point, which was right on the corner of High Street, which is the street my daughter lives in now. And we were there for quite some time. And then our marriage didn't work out, and my wife went to Melbourne, and I just continued with my hire car. And then Lila and I became friends, and we came up here. We got married and came up here to live, and we looked at a unit at down near the bowling club, and it was exactly where we would have liked to have lived. And the lady, everything was put in place, and we just couldn't get the lady to come up with a final settlement at any time. So we left the Rocks area and bought this place. I came up one day and Lila was working, and I said, I've seen a little place, but it's got a deposit on it, but it's a fantastic view and I think you'll like it. So she took some time off and jumped on the train and came up, and we bought this little place, and we've been here 26 years.
Yeah, that's pretty good, Laurie. Laurie, can I take you back to Miller's Point again? When the first time that you came to Miller's Point, which year was that?
That would have been approximately 1951, could have been early 1952.
So what were your impressions of Miller's Point at that time?
I loved the place. I rented a little unit. The Maritime Service Board was in charge of most of the properties in the area in those days, and they would let it out to a head lease, and the head lease would then make the property into as many units they could to get, and then they would sublet them out and therefore become landlords and make a living from them. And it seemed to work very, very well. And most of the properties along the lower Fort Street and around into the Argyle Street area were all managed in that manner, and the properties were treated as the people's own, and if you had a maintenance problem, the Maritime Service Board were contacted and they would come and repair it, and it worked well. But the people in the area were more like a big family than they were of, everybody knew everybody, everybody helped everybody. If someone had an illness or a problem and they were not covered by workers' compensation, there would be raffles run in all the hotels and functions run in the hall. It was just like a big country community in the middle of town. And I've, in many places that I've been during my life, I've never met a group of people that were a community like them. It was a marvellous place to live.
What was the number in Lower Fort Street where you first started?
Number 3.
And do you remember the name of the landlady?
Landlady was Mrs. Hilly. And her husband, I think, was Ted. And he passed away not so long after we went there. But even though we were renting there or subletting from her, you then went onto a list to, and they used to hold ballots when properties became available, which wasn't that often. Someone had to virtually pass away for their property to become available, and then in some instance they would hand it on to some of their children. And then things started to change when they formed the Rocks Redevelopment Group, which in my opinion was the beginning of the end of the original old Rocks, because instead of redeveloping it and keeping it in the atmosphere that it had, they wanted to change things, and different people moved into the area, and that was always a sore point with a lot of the locals, because some of the people that had been waiting on lists for some time were shortchanged because somebody succeed or went ahead of them to get a property, and that was when the family group of the Rocks started to disintegrate. And I went on a list, and eventually I got the place in at 18A High Street, which is where Margaret, my daughter, now lives. You've probably been there. And it was quite a comfortable place to live, and Lila and I lived there for some time, but the ships were a bit of a problem when they built the wharves down on the lower road, because they used to come in and they used to work all night, and they had one ship, I can't recall the name of it now, but it used to come in loaded with cars, and it had this thumping big engine that used to thump all night. But you couldn't blame the Rocks for that, them being there, because eventually I think that area will all go, because it's now become so valuable, and the people that we call guppies, for the want of another name, the young people with plenty of money that can afford to pay all sorts of prices to be where they want to be, are now moving into the area, and it's not the same as it was.
So, can you describe then the kind of families that lived in Lower Fort Street and High Street when you were living there? Who were the neighbours, and what were their names, and can you tell me more about them?
Well, there was one of the ladies that lived near us was Shirley Ball, and her husband. Shirley was always very active in any movement that was taking place within the area, and was on several committees. It's so long ago, most of the names. Baz and Ez Thomas, they lived there. Baz used to run an egg delivery service, which there were plenty of them about in those days. And around in the High Street area were Pat and Tony Bradford. They were very, very good friends of ours. And Pat was a good dancer. She used to organise a lot of the activities if there was any fundraising to be done. And Tony became Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney when, I think it was just prior to, I can't remember who the Lord Mayor was at the time, but Tony was the Deputy Lord Mayor, and that gave us a little bit of political pull in our area if we wanted something done. But most of the people living in the area were either waterside workers or tele clerks that were connected with the waterside workers, or customs officers, or in some way connected with the maritime, like tugboat drivers and things like that, and wharfies. A lot of people were wharfies, but there's so many of them. Tommy Donnelly and his father, they used to live next door to us in High Street, and they were all waterside workers. And Neil Craig Roberts, he used to work on the coal. In those days, they used to have the little coal boats go from Newcastle into Sydney Harbour, and they used to go right up the river as far as they could get and unload their coal, and that was where the ships used to go to bunker their coal for the trips. And they worked on the coal, but nearly everybody in the area worked in something related to the maritime industry in one form or another.
But you weren't working for the waterfront at all. How did you manage to get a sort of residence in there?
Well, because I'd lived there, I was renting in the property for so long, or subletting in the property for so long, that once you were there and you were considered to be a resident in the area, you went on to this ballot. And as you gradually worked your way up to the top of the ballot, and the only people that used to undercut us were people that used to come in, and that came in the later stages when this Rocks redevelopment movement came along.
So you're living quite a while at 3 Lower Fort Street.
Yes.
How many years were you there, Laurie?
Oh, probably 12, 14 years, something in that field. Most of Margaret's life, primary school were there. And then we moved around into the place we got it at High Street.
So where did Margaret go to school? Which schools did she attend?
She went to St. Pat's primary school, and then she went to St. Pat's, the big school down in the city. But my mother-in-law, my first wife's mother, Daphne Stapleton, she was one of the old stalwarts, real old stalwart. Anyone that was sick, Daph was there. And she used to live on the other side of us, downstairs in the... It was a magic place to live. You had looked out the kitchen windows and you were looking at Luna Park across the water. And I could lay in bed when I lived at number three and watch the flying boats land down at Rose Bay. And it was really a magic place to live. I loved it, but most of all the people.
What was it so special then about the people that you liked so much?
They were just like a big family. It was, there were the Kays and the Lux and the McCuddens. I think the McCuddens, they lived a little bit further around near the Palisade Hotel. And there were two or three boys, two for sure, and I think the other one moved away. And their father was the last bare-knuckle boxing champion in Australia, and the boys used to try and live up to that reputation, which sometimes got them into a bit of trouble. But and up past us was, as I say, the Kays and the Lux. They were all big families, three or four people all living, you know. The young people seemed to stay at home in that area, mainly because their work was there and the cheapness of living there in those days. I can't recall the rents now, but I know down in Lower Fort Street I was paying something like £7 a week, which was reasonable accommodation in those days.
£7, that would have been a lot.
Well, it was, that's for memory, it was £7 a week. And then I can't recall what it was when we went around to High Street, but I know it's nothing like what it is today.
How many rooms did you rent there at Lower Fort Street?
I had a bedroom, a lounge room, and went down two steps into a kitchen, which was just a closed-in balcony, and shared a bathroom, which was on the middle floor. And that was a three-floor place. One was below ground level, one was ground level, and we were the one above ground level. But it was a magic place to live, and in those days the hotels used to close at 6 o'clock, and then they got to the stage where they used to close at 6 o'clock and open again at 7 o'clock. They used to have the hour break to send the drunks home, and the drunks used to get a bottle of beer or a bottle of wine and sit under that bridge and drink it until the pub opened again at 7 o'clock.
But, you mean 7 in the morning?
No, they used to close from 6 till 7 p.m. and then they'd open again and close at 10.
That's strange, isn't it?
Well, it was supposed to be to stop the drunks, to send the drunks home, and then people could go home that were working in the area and come back at 7 o'clock and have a quiet drink, but it didn't work.
You couldn't stop the drunks, right? Okay, I'll just make an announcement, Laurie. It's the end of tape number MPFH7, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH7, side B. Laurie, Mrs. Hilly, your landlady, what was she like? What was her life like as a landlady?
Little short, fat lady, like mum to everybody that knew her, and very helpful, never caused any stress for anyone. She was a lovely old lady.
Was a life a hard life?
I wouldn't think it was a hard life, but they didn't ever want to move from there. I think they could have moved. He had, I think he worked for the customs department, for memory, and he always had a good job and always worked, and they seemed to have everything they wanted to have, and they had the income from the rent payers, and their daughter moved to a place, I think it was Seven Hills, when the early development of Seven Hills, and I know she wanted her mother and father to move into that area to be near them, but they couldn't be moved. They wouldn't go.
So once you fell in love with Millers Point, you like Millers Point, is that
right? I love it, yeah. But they've spoiled it. They've ruined it.
We'll get into that in a second. Now, you said that people, like neighbours, will always help each other. Were you helped in any way by the neighbours too?
Oh, yes. If I had any mechanical problems with my vehicle or my truck, there's always someone to come and help me. Fortunately, in those days, I kept pretty good health. But you had to feel it. It was just a great place to be. And when we used to have the Argyle Rocks centenaries that they used to have every year, I would venture to say there wouldn't be anybody living in the area that wasn't involved in one form or another. And that was a marvellous thing. They used to have contestants, and whoever raised the most money became the king or queen for the next 12 months, which entitled you to a beer in any one of the hotels or something. And it was more of an honour than a financial gain.
Tell me a little bit about the hotels. I mean, did you frequent any of the pubs and what sort of...
You bet.
Yeah?
The Harbour View was, when I lived at Lower Fort Street, the Harbour View was my waterhole, which was just still there underneath the Harbour Bridge. And I can't remember the names of the licensees now, it was so long ago, but there was no shortage of hotels in the area, and most of them, for history's sake, are still there. I know some of them went through some...
Just a moment, hang on. Laurie, I believe the hotels even had their own bookies, did they, SPs?
Yeah, well, I was never a punter, but you could always get a bet on. And everywhere had SPs in those days, but every hotel had their own SP. And if he wasn't there, he'd have someone there that was. There were people, I knew one chap that used to work on the waterfront, and he was a runner for the SP bookmaker who used to work in the Palisade. That was when Pat Armstrong had the Palisade, and this chap's job at work was to take the money and run the bets to the hotel and put the bets on and then collect the money and take it back and return with the bets again. But every hotel had their SP bookies in those days.
Were the cops onto that?
Well, everyone used to say, oh, it's not a big problem. We usually know when they're coming.
They were tipped off, were they?
Well, that was the general opinion of people. My wife might be able to fill you in a little bit better on that a little later.
Right. Your wife was a publican's wife.
Yes.
So she would know about all that, huh?
Well, everyone knew about it. There was no secret that there... Actually, while I was living there, we had a mayor, not a mayor, of Armstrong. Yeah, he was a mayor, I think, wasn't he? Or a member of parliament. And he used to live in Manly, and it was common knowledge that he was... ran several bookie shops around the area.
Member of Parliament. Now, let's talk a bit about the waterfront. Did you ever go down there to see what was happening down there in terms of work and conditions?
Well, I tried for some time to get a job on the tugboats, and I thought my experience in the Navy might have helped me, but I'd have probably still been on the list because it was a very, very popular job. And if you were there, you got your son a job there, and if I was there, I got my brother-in-law a job there, and that's the way it went. It didn't go in off the list like through the union movement like it should have, but I gave up because I just couldn't get a job there, and I didn't fancy being a wharfie. I could have got a job on the waterfront as a wharfie, but I just had this desire to work for myself, and so I went off on the other tangent. I'd have probably been a lot better off had I stayed... worked on the waterfront, knowing some of the chaps and that I now play bowls with that were wharfies in that area, far more comfortable financially than I am.
But you had more fun, right?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed doing what I did, and it was interesting. Yeah, I've never regretted much of what I've done.
Now, you said you bought a hire car, and you had a business running this hire car. What kind of car was it?
It was a Mercedes-Benz. I had a Ford first, and I converted that to a Mercedes-Benz because a chap that lived at Rose Bay, that Brown, Les Brown, he had a Mercedes, and Legion Cabs had just gone into a co-op situation where they were taking in hire cars to do wedding work. And Les contacted me and he said, well, one Mercedes is not much good. I can't afford another one at the moment. Will you and I work together doing weddings and have two Mercedes instead of just having one and other cars? So we both joined Legion Hire Cars Co-op, and we used to always work together and sometimes do two or three weddings of a Saturday. And then it got busier and busier and busier, and the hire car business went very well for Legion and for all of us. We did very well out of it. And then when I bought my hire car plate, it was reasonably cheap. And when I sold it, they'd gone up quite substantially in price, which gave me the opportunity to get another truck and a better truck. And then someone came to me with a proposition to sell my truck and go into be a sleeping partner in a real estate business out at Rockdale. And I did that, and that promptly cost me $27,000 in a very short space, pounds, in a very short space of time. So I flashed before my eyes a saying my father had, don't ever go into anything that you don't understand that involves money. And it's true.
Now, while you still had the hire car, I believe you drove some pretty important people around. One of the stories Margaret told me was that you drove Johnny O'Keefe around. Tell me that story about
Johnny O'Keefe and I became very, very close friends. I had a key to Johnny's house, and when he lived at Castle Crag, and he'd ring me. He was one of my customers initially when he used to do Sydney Tonight, and he used to get a lot of his acts from Checkers, the nightclub down in no, the bottom end of town, Checkers, were down near the Tivoli. And he'd say, look, go down, pick up a carload of girls, bring them to the studio, which was at Epping. They're going to do a spot during the break in the Tivoli show. So the girls would do a show, the early show at the Tivoli. I'd pick them up, sometimes as many as six of them in the car, and they'd get in wearing one outfit and get out wearing something else for the TV show, because they had a limited amount of time to do the spot they were doing on the TV show, and then I'd take them back to the Tivoli, and then I'd go back and wait for Johnny, or if he was going out somewhere from there, he might contact me and say, oh, don't worry about coming back for me. And that usually meant I'd get a phone call about 3 o'clock in the morning to say, I'm at the 729 Club, you better come and take me home, I'm a bit elephant drunk. Elephant's trunk, he used to say. So, and, oh, he was very good to me, never queried his account. When he went overseas, I used to look after his unit for him because his marriage had broken down at that stage. And sometimes he'd ring me and say, go and get me a brown suit or a blue suit, and whatever it is, the accessories you can find to go with it, you know how I dress, and meet me at the 729 Club, I've got to do a show or something, and I'd meet him there, and many of the time we've been swept out of the 729 Club very, very early hours in the morning, but I drove Don Lane quite often, and secretary manager of South Sydney Junior Leagues. Not junior leagues, the leagues club, South Sydney Leagues. And I was trying to think of his name only on Thursday, and I can't recall his name. But he came, fell on hard times when South Sydney started to go bad. But he was, I used to drive him a lot.
And getting back to Johnny O'Keefe, Margaret told me a story about him throwing a television set through a window. I said, is that right? And can you tell me about that one?
I didn't actually see the television go through the window. I saw the results. I saw the window. But yeah, he wasn't the easiest person in the world to get on with unless you were on the same wavelength as he was.
Well, they called him the wild one, didn't they?
Yeah. The funniest chap, the chap that used to do this, I believe, Eric Balham. I used to drive him a lot. And he was quite insane. We were coming across the Harbour Bridge one night. We used to go to the studio and do this, I believe, which was a new commentary. I guess the tapes would still be around from him. And he used to do this program, and then I'd drive him usually back into the city. And he lived at Kirribilli, but I'd drive him into the city, and he'd either go to City Tats or the cycle club. And this particular night, we were coming down through North Sydney, and a chap came out in front of us and cut us off and what have you. And Eric Balham says, "Get up alongside him, get up alongside him. I'll bloody tell him something." And so when we got anywhere near him, we were on the Harbour Bridge, and he produced a revolver. And I said, "What are you going to do with that?" He said, "I ought to shoot the mongrel," he said. "Hey, talk to me like that." I said, "He's probably talking to me. He's not talking. I don't care," he said. But he was a real character. Anyway, the revolver, I didn't see where it came from or where it went, but it disappeared, but it was sure as hell a revolver. He was quite an eccentric person.
Now, Laurie, what was it like parking a very expensive Mercedes-Benz in Millers Point? Did you get some funny stares from the people there?
Oh, no, my car was always, it was parked in the street because we had no, there was no parking facilities in the area, which you'd know. And I used to keep, my car was always spotless. I'm sorry to say, it's not the same, my present car. I seem to have lost interest. But, and it wasn't there very long because we used to do a lot of government work for the Department of Supply, and they found it was cheaper to use us to meet aeroplanes late at night than it was to pay their drivers and operate their cars. And Legion had a contract with the Department of Supply, and we would get a list of work that would probably take you most of the night to complete for some of the politicians that go to meetings and functions at night and were entitled to a car. It was cheaper for them to use our vehicles than it was to use the Commonwealth drivers because of the overtime involved.
Right. Now, Laurie, when you lived in 18 High Street, 18A, that's upstairs, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. How many rooms did you have there, and what did it look like up there?
There was a balcony looking out over what is known as the Lower Road, and that led into a dining room, or which we had as a lounge room. Then there were two bedrooms, and then the dining room, which was virtually the kitchen, wasn't it? And then there was a little laundry behind that. And then you went up some stairs onto an open-air area where the clotheslines were on the roof.
Now, were the Maritime Services Board the landlords when you were living there?
Yes. And it was during that time, I think, or just about when we left, that the Housing Commission, or as it was called in those days, the Housing Commission, started to become involved.
Do you know anything about the big battle that the landladies had with the Department of Housing over that?
No, I never got involved. I know Shirley Ball was... I don't know whether Shirley is still with us or not. But she would be the person to talk about that era, and because she was very much involved in it.
Yeah, she's passed on now, Shirley.
She has gone, has she?
Yes, yes.
Unfortunate, because she would have been able to give you a lot of good material.
Yeah, I know. We've got her offsider to speak for her. Yeah. So would you say the people at Millers Point, were they fairly well off, or were they very poor families as a rule, would you say, when you first came especially?
Oh, there were some people there that were comfortable, but I think the majority of them were just ordinary medium income earners. I don't think there was anyone there making huge amounts of money. And it was just an in place to live, and it was a great place to live. I've never met a community of people that I got so attached to. I've been here for 26 years. Pardon me. I couldn't tell you who lives in the third house from here, or who lives... I know the gentleman next door on my right, because we go fishing together and we play bowls together, but I couldn't tell you the name of the lady that lives next door to him.
And you would have known him?
I'd have known everybody. I could have gone down the street. The main problem was, if you went anywhere, oh, you're going to have a drink? And you'd go and have a drink, and there's no shortage of hotels in the area, as you know. But you just knew everyone, because everyone was involved in whatever was happening in the place.
Now, were there any sort of other ethnic groups in the area, whether Italians or Chinese or any non-Australians?
No, very, very few. And mainly all Australian or English nationalities. And I don't know of any people that were Asian, or... Of course, there wasn't the number of them in the country then that there is today, so I guess there's got to be some... They're pretty widespread now. Yeah. Because of our migration system, they seem to let more and more people in every year.
Now, I believe that the residents used to organise Christmas outings or parties. Can you tell me about that?
They weren't really parties. We just... New Year's Eve was the big occasion. Christmas parties were usually organised between two or three groups of families. But New Year's Eve, particularly in Lower Fort Street and High Street, about 11:30, people used to start emerging out in the street with a couple of bottles of beer or a bottle of wine or a plate of sandwiches and what have you. And they'd just sort of stand around and talk amongst themselves. And when it came midnight, everyone would go around and wish everyone else a happy New Year and watch the fireworks, usually some fireworks going on somewhere. And then they'd just... Someone might say, oh, I'll come back to our place and have a couple of drinks, or someone else, or a few would go off and go to some party, and someone else would go off and go to another party. Nothing seemed to be organised, but it just happened. It was great.
What about for your children? Was it safe for them to walk around the streets alone?
Well, they did. There wasn't a problem. It's very much... I wouldn't like to be walking around there on my own at night, but I walked around there and used to go and have a few beers and go home. And particularly when I was living on my own, I was probably going home later than normal, and I wasn't... never felt unsafe in the area at all, but I wouldn't like to walk around there at night now. Oh, a lot of other places either.
So would Margaret be able to stay out till 9 o'clock at night?
Oh, yeah, Margaret used to go to her girlfriend's places and come home. I never went to pick her up. She'd always come home, or they might walk home, and then the other girl would go home. But we didn't have... Actually, the crime rate in the area, I think... you didn't hear of cars getting stolen. You didn't hear of... You might hear that there's been a bit of a blue in one of the hotels, particularly if there was an English ship in for some reason. It might have been a flow-on from something that happened on the ship when it was here previously, but a few of the boys would go looking for the crew to make them feel a bit unwelcome.
I believe, Laurie, you have a story to tell me about a murder at Millers Point.
Oh, I can't say too much about that, but it happened. And the person who was involved is no longer with us, but I wouldn't repeat his name. And I know his son quite well. And,
You mean the killer?
Pardon?
You mean the killer?
Yeah. I don't know who the chap was that was unfortunate to be on the receiving end. Well, if I did know, I can't remember. That's honest. I know who the chap was, the murderer was, but nothing ever came of it. I never ever saw it, anything about it in the paper, and that's the way it was down there. You used to be able to go into Lila's, my wife's hotel when she was there. You'd go in on Wednesday and there'd be a particular person, again, I won't mention any names because families might be still living in the area. He'd say, do you want something on Friday? Oh, yeah, I'll have one of rum and one of scotch. And how are you up for shirts? Oh, yeah, I could do with a couple of shirts. I've got some good radios. Do you want a portable radio? And most of the stuff was stuff that had been stolen or contraband, or actually just recently I suppose we all could have been put in jail for receiving stolen goods, because you virtually knew, you never saw them being stolen, but you virtually knew that they, you just put in your order and got what you wanted, an electric stove or a radio or whatever. And the whiskey and the rum you used to get was Bond rum and Bond whiskey. It wasn't the lolly water you buy over the bars today. And they would have a list, and you'd go down on Friday afternoon and you'd pay the money and get the goods. And that went on in other hotels as well. There was a tremendous amount of stuff. But I think they clamped down on the wharf. That's where most of the stuff was coming from, wharfs and warehouses and things. But you shouldn't have done it, I suppose, but everyone else was. So what was, you know, as a matter of fact, I only recently threw out a radio that I'd acquired, which would have to have been 30 years ago.
They had a good long life, didn't they?
Yeah.
Going back to that murder, do you know why this man was murdered?
I got no idea. I just pulled up in my truck and it happened. That was it. And I just got out of my truck and the chap walked into the pub and I walked into the pub and the next thing all the ambulance and police and everything were there. And did anyone see anything? No.
Was he shot in the pub?
No, out in the footpath.
In broad daylight?
About 5 o'clock one afternoon.
And you didn't see it actually happen, did you?
Well, I saw the bloke falling to the ground. I didn't actually see the bullet.
And you recognised the killer?
I recognised him, yes.
And the police didn't do anything about it, nothing?
Well, they probably interviewed a lot of people. They never interviewed me. But I wouldn't have seen it if they had. Because that was the sort of community that was there. You looked after one another, but you didn't dob in your mates.
Oh, yeah, there'd be repercussions, wouldn't it?
Yes. And you daren't not buy a raffle ticket if Joe Blow was homesick and couldn't go to work and he wasn't getting compo and you went in the pub Friday or Saturday, and this would be any pub in the area because they would all be running raffles. And the money would go into a group and then they would sort it out and pay, make sure he got his wages every week out of it. And if you went in, you weren't very popular. If you said, oh, no, I'm not going to buy any tickets today, it was just done. And you never know when it was going to be your turn to be. I could have been hurt somewhere and they'd have looked after me just the same.
So the community actually had expectations about what they wanted you to be and contribute and so on.
Yeah, it was more or less... That's the way we do it here. If bills, I can remember when one of the luck boys, Jim, can't remember the boy's name now, but...
Albert? Was it Albert? There's an Albert Luck.
No, it wasn't him.
Albert.
Jimmy, Purse. The other one.
Was it Keith?
And it might come to me in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Jimmy Luck. Anyway, he was doing something, cleaning out a gutter or something, and he fell and got injured on a spike that was part of the fence that he was working near. And he was therefore not covered by compo or anything. And he was off for quite an extended period of time. And Pat and Tony Bradford started a fund going for him, and there was Gail Bradford's husband, Sale. Was his surname? I can't think of his first name either. And they formed a committee, and all the money from the groups were put into this fund, and any expenses and that they had was all paid for out of this. It was all raised by people in the community, and you just hoped it didn't happen to you, but knowingly in your own mind that if something happened to you, you'd get the same sort of assistance as you're giving someone else, and it seemed to work very, very well.
Wonderful community.
It was. It's a great community.
Now, I believe the pubs also organise picnics and other things. What sort of things did they do?
Yeah, they used to have social clubs. The Palisade always had a very, very strong social golf club. And they used to have days where they used to have go to a golf club and have a picnic, and the ladies would turn up afterwards, and the golfers would come back and they'd meet at Narrabeen Lakes or something like that. And they'd have a couple of kegs of beer on the back of a truck and prizes, and then events for the kids and ice creams and drinks and things and plenty of food. And they used to have one nearly every year, a big one of those. Yeah, that was. I think the ALP had something to do with running that. Harry Thompson was involved in getting us a lot of stuff that, you know, from sponsors and things for. Through the ALP for the... It was a very, very strong ALP area in those days. I'm not familiar with what it is today politically.
Right. Do you think you're a different person for having lived in Millers Point? Do you think it's influenced your life?
Oh, it didn't do me any harm. I wasn't the best fighter in Millers Point. I got myself into a few situations where I had to take evasive action because I was and able to take care of the situation I'd probably created. But you always knew you had some mates around your place. Ronnie Rotsford, who was a great mate of mine, he's gone now. He was one of the known identities around the place, and Ron and I were very good friends. You didn't feel intimidated by anyone. It was just a great family atmosphere. And I've rued the day they ever... I'd have liked to put a big fence around the rocks, kept everyone else out and let the community stay where they were and leave it alone. And that would have been something unique in the world, and it would have been a unique group of people.
When you say the rocks, you mean you also include Millers Point, do you?
Yeah, Millers Point and the rocks. Well, it's we used to say the rocks was from Argyle Place down to the bridge, back up past the Garrison Church, around to the end of High Street and back down Gloucester Street, I think it was. But that was called the Rocks, the whole area, not just what they call the Rocks today. But if they could have just kept that and left it alone and let the people have the cheap rents that were living in there, they'd have kept them. Most of them had to move out because they couldn't afford the rents.
We'll just take a break. This is the end of tape number MPFH 7, side B.